to the latest episode of The Lancet Neurology in Conversation With. I'm Sarah Passy, a senior editor at The Lancet Neurology. For our May podcast, I am delighted to be joined by Jacqueline French and Jacob Pellinen, who are co-authors on a review published in our May issue about the diagnosis of epilepsy. Dr. French is Professor of Neurology at New York University Grossman School of Medicine, Chief Medical Innovation Officer of the Epilepsy Foundation, and is Director of the Epilepsy Study Consortium. And Dr. Pellinen is Assistant Professor of Neurology based at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Jackie and Jacob, welcome to the podcast. And to start us off, please can you each introduce yourself for our listeners and tell them a bit about your work.
Hi, I'm Jackie French. Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure. I have spent my life really looking at outcomes of epilepsy. And as a result of that, I was one of the investigators of a large study called the Human Epilepsy Project. And the Human Epilepsy Project, the intent originally was to enroll people with newly diagnosed epilepsy and follow them to determine the thing that epileptologists really want to know, which is what makes some people treatment resistant and some people treatment sensitive. And I think probably your listeners know that with newly diagnosed epilepsy, and this is focal epilepsy we're talking about two-thirds of the time people respond to medication and a third of the time they don't respond. And it's very difficult to know who's going to be who in the beginning. So it really was a biomarker study to begin with. But in order to get biomarkers, you have to really amass very detailed information about people as they come in the door. And that detailed information has allowed us to sort of look at other things. And one of the things is how long it took each of those people to come to a diagnosis. And that has made me very interested in general in the concept of delay to diagnosis. And, I've sort of made that a mini passion.
Great. And I'm Jacob Pellinen. I'm a neurologist and epileptologist and assistant professor at the University of Colorado. I first got to know Dr. French when I was in training at NYU, and that's where I developed a strong interest in investigating the delay to diagnosis in people with epilepsy. That has been a big part of my initial career at the University of Colorado, along with interests in quality improvement and overall improving the quality of care for people with epilepsy at our center.
Great, thank you. So moving to the review, something that caught my eye in particular was the statistic that up to three quarters of people with epilepsy experience a delay in their diagnosis. And this seems quite a shockingly high proportion, really. So could you tell us what are the main reasons for diagnosis delay and how could this proportion be reduced?
So the thing about epilepsy is it is the epilepsies. So there are many different reasons in different groups. Epilepsy, as you know, can happen from cradle to grave. And the types of seizures that occur can be anything from a sudden feeling or a little brief lapse in attention all the way to what I call the television seizure. And the television seizure, which is the one that the public knows is epilepsy. And really, you know, in order to be diagnosed, you have to understand there's something wrong that needs attention paid to it. The television seizure is the one where you fall down on the ground, you shake all over, you froth at the mouth, you're completely unconscious, otherwise known as a tonic-clonic convulsion. But in fact, that is not the initial seizure in the majority of people who develop epilepsy, whether they be children or adults. And when other seizures happen, people really don't know what to make of it. They, you know, just imagine to yourself, and I've heard these stories over and over and over again, so I'm just going to give you one exemplary story. A young man who notably happens to be related to a neurologist told me that at one point when he was an adolescent, he had these episodes daily where he would hear all the music in the universe at once, and it would last for 30 seconds. And during the time that he heard that, he realized that what other people in the room were saying to him was fading away. He couldn't really understand what people were saying, but it was 30 seconds long. And then afterwards, he would be completely fine again. And this happened to him every single day. Now, I don't know what you think you would do if suddenly you heard all the music in the world at once for 30 seconds a day, but a lot of people think this is not something that perhaps they go to a doctor about. Maybe they, you know, they feel like they should go to an exorcist or something like that, but it doesn't strike them that this is a medical condition. And, you know, I can even tell you a story that I had a patient who was a neurologist and was having these brief, what we call non-motor seizures. In his case, it was a deja vu feeling. And it happened quite frequently. And it did not occur to him that they were seizures. The ironic thing is that eventually he had a tonic-clonic seizure and came to me for evaluation. Even then, he hadn't put them together to say that these small episodes were associated with the big episode. So it clearly, for whatever reason, is not something that clicks with people, I should go see a doctor. And that leads to delay. And then, you know, when people do go see a doctor, quite honestly, often the doctor doesn't know any more what to do with it than the patient does. So then the person experiencing the symptoms does. I spoke to a woman who was around the time of menopause, and she was having these strange feelings episodically. And she went to a doctor, and the doctor told her that this was menopause. And then when she started to have urinary incontinence during her seizure episodes, she was sent to a urologist because they said, you know, now she had menopause and she was having incontinence with her menopause. And the fact that this was only happening during these brief episodes didn't seem to impress the doctors enough to put that together and say maybe this was something else. And unfortunately, in her case, the ultimate conclusion was she, again, as is so often the case, she was diagnosed only after she had a tonic-clonic convulsion. And at that time, when neuroimaging was performed, she had a tumor. And that's what was causing the seizures. So there was a long delay that actually, in that case, was very consequential for her. But, you know, even when it's not something that's progressive like a tumor, the fact that the epilepsy is not diagnosed at the time that the smaller episodes are happening, and that it often evolves to the larger tonic-clonic convulsion before a diagnosis is made, leads to enormous unnecessary injuries. We actually, Dr. Pellin and I, did a study where we found that 5% of people who are undiagnosed in this way will have a car accident while waiting to be diagnosed. So there are social consequences and there are consequences to the individual.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, it brings it up to the next question, really, because obviously it's recognizing the sort of the signs, the symptoms. And so you present this overview in the review about the primary steps in making a diagnosis, and that includes this history taking, which I suppose is where we find out all this background. But you mentioned several innovations that were on the horizon to diagnosis. So could you tell our listeners about some of these newer diagnostic techniques and which you think could have the greatest potential to improve diagnosis?
Yes. Well, when looking at the newer tools that can help with diagnosis, they all really build on that improving the clinical history taking and the information physicians have at their fingertips, either during the first encounter or shortly thereafter. And it's important to remember, and what Dr. French had alluded to, is that the diagnosis of epilepsy is often purely based on clinical history. So improving that initial information that a physician has at their fingertips. And of course, the education that healthcare providers get in regard to seizures and epilepsy is of critical importance. But one thing that's been a huge asset and innovation in the last several years has been leveraging the power of smartphones. And so smartphones are present in over 80% of households in high-income countries and around 30% in low-income countries as of a few years ago. And those numbers are rapidly growing. And one of the reasons we can lean into that technology is that it's been found that video alone, even without EEG, has been shown to be effective in discriminating between epileptic seizures and non-epileptic or functional seizures with relatively high accuracy. So in 2021, a prospective study actually compared epileptologist diagnosis based purely on the smartphone videos with diagnoses based on video EEG for the same events in the same individuals and found a 94% diagnostic concordance, which is huge. And expanding on that, there have been innovations in home video monitoring systems. So even without EEGs, there was a group that developed a high-definition camera and a microphone that can be placed in an individual's bedroom, which streams data to a central computer using a secure internet connection and can capture events that are concerning for seizures. And there have also been advancements in ambulatory EEG monitoring and video technology, both that improve on the quality of EEG and improve the video capture of events. And one thing on the horizon and associated with all of that is the machine learning processes that are being developed to detect clinical events in real time. Because of course, experts can't be in front of computers and videos monitoring 24/7, 7 days a week to see when people have events. And so leveraging machine learning and AI to detect concerning events, clip those events, and then sending those specific events to experts for review will be a huge development going into the future. And of course, it's important to remember developing that technology needs to also take cultural factors, privacy, and ethical issues into consideration in the same way that telemedicine has done as it's been growing.
Great, thank you. So moving on to sort of classifications, formal classifications, and the International League Against Epilepsy has recently published these criteria to help clinicians make a diagnosis of epilepsy by type and syndrome. So what impact have these criteria had, and does anything more need to be done?
So I just want to remind people that when you make a diagnosis of epilepsy, you know, this is not something else. This is not migraine. This is epilepsy. It's not non-epileptic seizures. A lot of people feel like they are done and they don't need to make any further diagnosis. But in fact, it is really, really important to not only make a diagnosis of epilepsy, but determine what type of epilepsy it is. So the International League Against Epilepsy subdivides epilepsy really into, I would say, three major groups and then an unknown group. So the three major groups are focal epilepsy, generalized epilepsy, and combined focal and generalized epilepsy. And making the diagnosis of what group somebody belongs in is sort of a two-way street, because you can either say, well, this person has these kinds of seizures, therefore they fall into this bucket, or you know other things about them that makes you decide that they belong in this bucket, and then you can decide what kind of seizures they have, you know, based on the EEG and other criteria. And the reason that it is so important to at least subdivide into one of those buckets of either all focal seizures, all generalized seizures, that is seizures that begin, as far as we know, really broadly spread throughout the brain, or a combination of those two, is that we have different medications that are appropriate depending on which you fall into. And whereas there are some medications that we call broad spectrum, which means that they really cover the landscape of all of the different groups, if people don't respond well to those broad spectrum medications, the medications that you would move to as second or third choice are often not broad spectrum. And if you give them to the wrong group, seizures can actually worsen. So, for example, if you have somebody who has tonic-clonic seizures can either occur for two reasons, or they can occur in all the different groups. But an adult with tonic-clonic seizures could either be having a focal onset, and we call those focal to bilateral tonic-clonic seizures because they start focally, although sometimes you can't even notice. There's the spread is so rapid that there's not a signature of the focality. Or they can occur as part of a generalized epilepsy, in which case we call them generalized tonic-clonic seizures. And if you treat somebody with tonic-clonic seizures, presuming that they have focal epilepsy and focal to bilateral tonic-clonic, with a narrow spectrum, particularly sodium channel drug, you can actually make them much worse, and you can cause other seizure types to emerge, such as absence seizures and myoclonic seizures. So it is important to distinguish at least that much. And then, if possible, a syndromic diagnosis is also very useful. And the International League Against Epilepsy has just done a very extensive process, which I really encourage people to explore, where they are very clearly describing each of the syndromes, the epilepsy syndromes, and also giving information about what you can see in terms of all the ancillary information, the age of onset, the EEG, the MRI, that would make it likely that they fall into that syndrome, and also that would make it very unlikely. So did you sort of make a misdiagnosis? There are red flags to say, well, if you see this, then perhaps they don't belong in that group. You better think about something else. And, you know, I do encourage that if people don't see epilepsy as their primary patient group, that if they have difficulty with determining what group somebody falls into, what their seizure type is and what their syndrome is, and it's not always that easy, that they should refer that person to an epilepsy specialist just to get that diagnosis. And then, you know, once the diagnosis is made, they can come back to the general neurologist and be followed and treated by that general neurologist. But it really is important to make sure that they know. I believe that it is every person with epilepsy's right to know what type of epilepsy they have, what syndrome they have, if they have a syndrome, and what group they fall into.
Thank you.
So coming to the end of your review now, you briefly discussed the challenges faced by people living in low-income and middle-income countries in receiving their epilepsy diagnosis. So could you explain some of these challenges and how might they be overcome?
Absolutely. So this topic is pretty extensive and could really be a separate review paper on its own, but because there are many challenges faced by people in low and middle income countries in obtaining a diagnosis of epilepsy. And the diagnostic gap, meaning those with active epilepsy who haven't been diagnosed, is estimated to be between 38 and 61% in these regions. So it's a pretty big issue. And many of the barriers are related to things like knowledge gaps regarding seizures and neurologic disease, stigma and cultural beliefs that may obstruct pathways to care. So on one hand, these can be extremely varied depending on the region. And on the other hand, there are some similar barriers across all regions, including high income, that just tend to be magnified in areas with fewer resources. So there are a number of current efforts already underway to improve diagnosis in low and middle income countries. And some of these things focus on the basics, such as expanding access to education and technology. And in particular, there is an educational intervention by the ILAE called their primary healthcare curriculum, which we mentioned in our paper, which supports healthcare providers in giving them additional skills and resources to deliver care to specifically to people presenting with seizures and new onset epilepsy. And then there are also efforts to bring mobile EEGs to regions that don't have EEG technology and utilize remote interpretation. So bringing the technology to where it's needed and utilizing the internet and skilled collaborators who may not be local to the region, but to provide telehealth and interpretations and additional training tools. And then there's been some development in the area of task shifting, which is the redistribution of tasks that would normally be done by highly qualified healthcare providers to the providers that are available in that region. So even if there aren't neurologists or epilepsy specialists in a particular area, they can be trained in specific skills that help with recognizing seizures and managing that initial care and improving referrals to centers for specialty care. And of course, there's global campaigns by international organizations which increase awareness, and that increasing awareness and of epilepsy and seizures can help promote more knowledge of the issue and can incentivize legislation to improve rights of people with epilepsy and other neurologic disorders and to help reduce stigma, which remains an important barrier to seeking appropriate medical care in many communities.
Thank you for highlighting those important points. And I think you're right. We probably should review those at some point in the future. So thank you both, Jackie and Jacob, for such an interesting discussion today. You can read the review about epilepsy diagnosis now at thelancet.com. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Lancet Neurology in Conversation With. And remember that you can subscribe wherever you usually get your podcasts.